And so all these powers are projected upon the Zen master. He is a Buddha. He is a master of life. And if he is, the reason why he is that he has discovered the unreality of the whole problem. A new branch. So because you say, oh well, we people are interested in higher things, you see, that depends still on the differentiation of rank between the superior and the inferior people. But when you begin to see through that and grow out of that, you don't think any more of this superior and inferior classification. You don't think we are spiritual people who attend to higher things as distinct from these morons who are only interested in beer and television. This is simply our particular form of life. Like there are crabs, and there are spiders, and there are sharks, and there are sparrows, and so on. The trouble with the human being is, like the trouble with certain animals, like the dinosaur, who evolved to the point where he was so big that he had to have two brains, a higher self.
As it was arranged at the moment when the individual was born, this was called his horoscope. The whole arrangement of the planets and the stars, as they were then known, as they were at the moment of your birth. And this was supposed to be a picture of your character and of your destiny. Now, there was a lot of superstition in this, but one thoroughly valid idea, that the real you,
figure, or an environment without organisms in it, or without things in it. You can't have space which is unoccupied by any solid. You cannot have solids not occupying some space. This is absolutely elementary, and yet we don't realize it. Because, for example, the average person thinks that space is nothing. It is just a sort of not-there-ness in which there are things. And we are slightly afraid that not-there-ness, that nothingness, that darkness, that the negative poles of all these oppositions will win. That they will eventually swallow up every kind of being and every kind of there-ness. But when you catch on to the game, you realize that that won't happen. Because what is called not existing is quite incapable of being there without the contrast of something called existing. It's like the crest and the trough of a wave. You can't have a wave that is all trough and no crest, just as you can't have a wave which is all crest and no trough. Such a thing has never been manifested in the physical universe. They go together. And that is the secret. There really is no other.
By Buddhists all over northern Asia, Tibet, China, and Japan. And it contains the saying, that which is void is precisely the world of form. That which is form is precisely the void. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form, so on. And it elaborates on this theme. It's very short, but it's always chanted at important Buddhist ceremonies. And so it is supposed by scholars of all kinds who have a missionary background that the Buddhists are nihilists, that they teach that the world is really nothing, there isn't anything, and that there seems to be something is purely an illusion. But of course this philosophy is much more subtle than that. The main person who was responsible for developing and maturing this philosophy was Nagarjuna.
That Confucius placed as the highest of all virtues, higher than righteousness, higher than benevolence, and it means approximately human-heartedness. Now, Confucius once said that goody-goodies are the thieves of virtue. Virtue in Chinese is de.
We romanize it as T-E-H, de. And it means virtue not in the sense of moral propriety, but virtue in the sense of magic, as when we speak of the healing virtues of a certain plant. A man of true virtue is therefore a human-hearted man. And the meaning of this is that one should, above all, trust human nature in the full recognition for which you are doing it, is still clinging and grasping. It is still self-protection. It is still lack of trust and love. So, when this is understood, the student returns to the
It's a very curious thing, but that idea of Yugen, which in Chinese characters means, as it were, a kind of the deep mystery of the valley. There's a poem in Chinese which says, "The wind drops, but the petals keep falling. The bird calls, and the mountain becomes more mysterious." Isn't that strange? There's no wind anymore, and yet petals are dropping. And a bird in the canyon cries. And that one sound in the mountains brings out the silence with a wallop. Like I remember when I was almost a child in the Pyrenees, in the southwest of France, we went way up in this gorgeous silence of the mountains.
Flattened out. So what has happened then is this, that our I is an illusion. It's an image. And it is no more ourself than an idol is the Godhead. But we say, it can't be so because I feel I really exist. It isn't just an idea in my head, it's a feeling. I feel me. Well, what is it that you feel when you feel I? Well, what is it that you feel when you feel I? I'll tell you. What do you do when somebody says, pay attention? What is the difference between looking at something and taking a hard look at it? Or between hearing something and listening intently? What's the difference? What's the difference between
Near the ceiling and a chain which you pull, and then there's a pipe which goes down from the tank to the seat. And on this pipe there is a little plaque with a big eye on it, this kind of eye, and underneath in Gothic lettering it says, "Thou God seest me." So in the most private apartment of the house, where one closes the door and locks it,
for better or for worse, we as Americans live in a culture in which there is nothing esoteric. There are no secrets, except those things which cannot be understood. In a way, they are always esoteric. Only a few people can understand them. And they don't need to be guarded, because even if you, for example, you publish a textbook on nuclear physics, and only very few people can understand it.
On one hand, molasses, feathers in the other, slap the two hands together and rub them around, and said, "Now pick off the feathers." So you see what happens. The teacher is well aware that he's played this trick on you, and he's going to see what will happen if you act, and he's going to help you to act, consistently on this foolishness. Now, you see, what he's done is he simply made a special case of what society does to us all anyhow.
And this is true of most cultures. The high cultures of the world, whether they're of the East or whether they're of the West, play a game on every new member. They don't know they're playing this game because their forefathers played it on them. And they are still its hopeless victims. The game is called the double bind. And necklaces of human heads. And then you start looking at those. And by Jove, in every eye on one of those human heads, you look inside it and there's another Buddha sitting there. See? And you go on like that forever and ever and ever in myriad detail. See? But now that is a state of consciousness which these artists are trying to represent. It is the idea of the Dharma Dhatu, which I explained in last seminar. That is to say, the net of jewels, where every jewel reflects all the other jewels, and therefore naturally contains the reflection of all the other jewels in each other jewel that it reflects. You see? The infinite interrelatedness, or they call it mutual penetration, of everything in the universe. And so this is an art form designed to get you into the mood to understand that. Now, when we take a stick, the stick has its two ends. They are the terms of the stick. But the ends of the stick do not exist as sort of separate points which encounter each other on the occasion of meeting at a stick. They are actually abstract points. The ends themselves, considered as themselves, are purely geometrical. They're Euclidean imaginations. The reality is the stick, you see? So in the same way with that phenomenon called experience, the reality is not an encounter of the knower and the known. The reality is an experience which can be termed as having two aspects, two ends, the knower and the known. But that's only a figure of speech. This is a double bind. And anybody who lives under the dominance of a double bind lives in a state of chronic frustration, because he is devoting his whole life to solving a meaningless, nonsensical problem. Let's take the double bind that is the deepest of all. You must go on living. Now, living is a spontaneous process. And to say to it, you must happen, is exactly the same thing as saying to any kind of creative artist, you must come through with the goods. Tonight you must give the superb performance, and above all, you must be unselfconscious. Well, this is being done to us all the time. And the object of the Zen discipline is that instead of doing this to people unconsciously, as parents do it and as teachers do it to children, and as the children's peers do it to their own peer members, in Zen the double bind is put on you deliberately, knowing how stupid it is. The teacher is well aware of everything he's doing and what tricks he's playing on you, because he has behind it all the compassionate intent of getting you into such a fierce double bind that you will see how stupid it is. So then, what happens is this. He gives you the double bind. Be genuine. I want to see you do something that is the real you. I had a friend who was studying Zen, and he was given some koan like this to work on.
But it just so happens that I have in front of me a fabulous instrument which the Japanese call koto. I suppose it would be best described as a table harp. Long instrument, stringed with bridges, horizontal harp.
And that's why the path of Buddhism is called the razor's edge. Because you see what happened. When all this kind of work in the course of history became fashionable, people began to affect these styles. For example, when Sesshu, the great master ink painter, worked, he would sometimes take a handful of straw and paint with that instead.
Where you say, I know I'm right just so long as I'm hurting. And all that is doing is expiating your kind of infantile guilt sense. So he said there is a middle way between asceticism on the one hand and hedonism on the other. But actually, the middle way is more subtle than that, and it's beautifully discussed in Professor Baum, a book called The Philosophy of Buddha. That's B-A-H-M, Professor of Philosophy at the University of New Mexico. And he gives a very, very fascinating analysis of the middle way in the form of a dialogue, whereby it works simply like this. The student brings a problem to the teacher, and he says, I suffer, and it's a problem to me. And the teacher says, you suffer because you desire. If you didn't desire, you wouldn't suffer. So try not to desire. And the student goes away and says, I'm not very successful in this. I can't stop desiring. It's terribly difficult. And furthermore, I find that in trying to stop desiring, I'm desiring to stop desiring. Now what am I to do about that? And the teacher replies, do not desire to stop desiring any more than you can. So the student goes away and practices that. But he comes back to the teacher and said, I still find myself desiring excessively to stop desiring, and it doesn't work. So the teacher says, do not desire too much, not to desire to stop desiring.
Well, it's a funny thing, but it's very difficult to be a complete atheist, real atheist. It's like in the House of Parliament in England, when in 1928 the Church of England wanted a new prayer book, a revised prayer book. Because the church and the state are inseparable in England, the Houses of Parliament had to vote on whether this prayer book might be used. And somebody got up and said, this is perfectly ridiculous. An assemblage which contains a number of atheists voting on the inner politics of the Church of England. And another member got up and he said, oh, I don't think there are any atheists here. Not really. We all believe in some sort of a something somewhere. Now you see, in the theological world, it just doesn't do to believe in some sort of a something somewhere. Because one thing that theologians detest is vagueness. You should...
Chassidim. The Ruach is the breath which God breathed into the nostrils of Adam. It is differing from the soul. The individual soul in Hebrew is called nephesh. And so we translate the Ruach into the Greek pneuma and the nephesh into psyche or psyche. The spirit And you ask a theologian, what's the difference between the soul and the spirit? And he won't be able to tell you. But it's very clear in St. Paul's writings. So the point is that the Ruach is the divine in the creature by virtue of which we are sons of or of the nature of God. Manifestations of the divine. This discovery is the gospel. That is the good news. But this has been perpetually repressed throughout the history of Western religion.
Westerners face certain forms of Mahayana Buddhism from the outside. They see what reminds them of total irrationality and superstition. And this, in particular, applies to a form of Buddhism which has several names, and they're all, well, it's really one form of Buddhism, but it's named differently. And they are all sub-schools of Mahayana. It's variously known as Vajrayana, Tantrayana, or Mantrayana. You remember the word yana means a course, basically, sometimes a vehicle. And Buddhism is fundamentally likened to a...
And all the rest of the universe is nothing more than an idea. It is not a real difference. And meditation is the way in which we come to feel our basic inseparability from the whole universe. And what that requires is that we shut up. That is to say, that we become interiorly silent and cease from...
And said, we have caused many monasteries to be built, monks and nuns to be ordained, and the scriptures to be translated into Chinese. What is the merit of this?